good afternoon. So last time we talked about how compilers don't optimize. So we mentioned compilers can do lots of optimizations and are often better at optimizations than a human might be, but they have some limitations which make them not perform optimizations, which might to us seem pretty simple, because they have to deal with things that we don't usually think about. And one of these was matching behavior on corner cases, that when there's these corner cases in the code, we as humans may know that this will never come up. And our big example of this was aliasing, that if we have two pointers, they can, you know, often point to the same thing. We as a human might know from the context of the function that you never call the function that way. You're never going to call the sum the rows of this matrix function where you're going to tell it to put the sums in the matrix itself. You'll never do that. That doesn't make sense. But the compiler, it doesn't know what the function's for. It just sees the code. It has to compile it exactly as written, handling those weird cases. And that's going to prevent it from doing things that we might assume would be a trivial thing to do, like keep values in registers while they're being computed. Compilers also usually end up working at a file at a time. So if compilers using that sort of object file system we learned at the beginning of the semester, well, the machine code for every object file is generated separately, and if I have a call from one object file to another, I can't make any assumptions about what's in the other object file's function because it could change before I make the executable. I could replace my printf.o with another printf.o, so I can't make optimizations based on what I think printf does internally. And similarly, even though we might have multiple functions in the same object file, compilers usually avoid trying to do lots of optimizations across different functions just for performance reasons. They do it, but that's very expensive. If we think of like having a, you know, a big file of like 10,000 lines, you know, we need some way of keeping us from trying to look for optimization patterns every single place. So a common way compilers do this is by trying to go a function at a time for the most part. Another thing compilers don't really understand is that they can't make trade-offs about code size. So a lot of the optimizations we talked about, like loop unrolling or cache blocking, make our code bigger. And they also will end up slowing things down if, like, we have a loop that doesn't actually run very much. And they'll slow things down both because we might add extra instructions to handle, you know, the leftover if it's not a multiple of our loop unrolling size, and because, well, it's just we have more code that has to get loaded into the instruction cache. If we keep doing that everywhere, our program that might have fit entirely in the instruction cache suddenly won't. And it's going to end up running slower. So because of these things, you know, we sometimes want to help the compiler along, and there's some optimizations where we kind of have to do them ourselves. Like cache blocking, we learned we probably have to do it ourselves, because with things like aliasing, you know, if the compiler is going to do it, it's going to probably need some help at the minimum. We also learned about one other optimization that comes up a lot, which is function inlining. So this is another thing that, like loop unrolling, is fairly simple for a compiler to do. It's pretty mechanical, and it's just taking a function call and replacing it with the body of that function. But to do it, we have to have access to the body of the function, and know that it's going to be worthwhile. And the reason why it might be worthwhile is that we're getting rid of a function call, return, all the argument setup stuff. It's going to be a nice benefit, but we're going to have extra copies of the function body. So if we did this all the time, our executables would become huge. So the compilers, you know, try to guess when it's definitely beneficial as far as when to do it, which might may or may not be as often as you want them to do it. Okay, so questions about these things we covered last time? Okay, so a brief logistics note. My office hours next Wednesday are moved slightly and reduced in time. I will also be helping out with the Tuesday afternoon office hours in exchange. So going to start by talking about one little optimization that comes up a bunch. And here we have a function where there's something we can do to make this loop faster. Can someone find out, like, what about this loop is likely to be unusually slow if we, you know, compiled it in the straightforward way? Back there? The string length call. So the way our for loop works, we're going to have to run that I less than string length comparison. And to do that, we have to run the string length function. And you might say, OK, well, the compiler should realize that the string doesn't change and just replace that with one call. But that's really hard for the compiler to do. In order for the compiler to do that, it needs to understand what the string length function does. For all the compiler typically would know, you know, maybe my string length function actually like returns a random number. Or maybe my string length function prints a string to the console. The compiler probably doesn't have the information that that's not happening, so it probably still needs to call the string length function. And also, in order for the compiler to know the string doesn't change, it needs to analyze all the code in the loop and figure out that it doesn't change the string. In this case, that's tractable, but we can easily get into scenarios where that's a very hard problem. So you as a programmer can really help the compiler out by just doing this optimization yourself of call string length only once and reuse that length. And you know, this is often something where if you do it, you know, you'll get this huge improvement and the compiler just won't be able to figure it out in most cases. So this pattern of seeing loops where we end up doing these operations, you know, that we could kind of move outside the loop happens a lot. And this is a sort of the simplest case where we're doing the same thing over and over. There's some cases where there are things where we can sort of subdivide our loop, where we're doing some check for kind of what region are we in. So an example might be this function here. So this function is basically copying from source at some offset to the destination, but making extra copies of the last thing in source once we get far enough, once we get beyond the end of the source. And the way, you know, I decided to implement this, I said, okay, well, I'm going to go for all the elements in my destination, and I'm going to check whether it's in range of source or not, and have those two cases. And this is a less obvious case where we're doing some redundant calculation that we don't really need to do. And that redundant calculation is that we're comparing I less than n and I plus amount less than n. And we as humans know that this function probably doesn't make sense if amount is negative. Or even if it is, we know that amount isn't changing. So like we can kind of pre-compute when that changeover will happen, and therefore avoid a comparison in this loop. And the way this would look, like here. So I say, OK, I know amount's positive, so we're going to first go from I to I plus amount, to n minus amount, and then from n minus amount to n. I'm going to do that as separate loops. So that saved that double comparison, so now we're only doing one comparison. And this sort of optimization is actually usually more beneficial than might be obvious. So saving a comparison, not worth very much. But now my two loops are much simpler. And this is going to allow us to apply other optimizations we might look at, including some we'll talk about later today, that would have been very hard on this original version. Because we have a comparison in the loop. This loop is very irregular right now. And we've suddenly turned this into a much more regular set of loops that's going to be easier to optimize. And this sort of pattern, notably, I'm mentioning it very explicitly because it comes up on the smooth assignment. The smooth assignment has this sort of structure where the initial code does a lot of these checks, but you know, once we get it into a version where our loops are nice and simple, we'll have a lot more options on how to optimize these loops when we don't have to worry about doing an if comparison all the time. So questions about our examples of redundant operations? Okay. So So we've talked about a bunch of optimizations. I have two questions here about a bunch of them. So which of them are likely to increase the size of the machine code? And which of them are likely to increase the number of instructions we execute? And note that these are different questions, which probably have different answers. Give you a minute or two. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks for, let's start with increasing the machine code size. So who thinks cache blocking would increase the machine code size? One volunteer. So I'll write down what answers people gave. So minus code size for cache blocking. For who thinks function inlining would increase the machine code size? So we have a definite consensus on that. Thinks loop unrolling would increase our machine code size. Okay. Who thinks moving a calculation outside a loop would increase our machine code size? Moving a calculation, okay. We have mostly no. And who thinks adding multiple accumulators after we've already added loop unrolling would increase our machine code size? Okay, so most people. So let's start with the simple ones. So I would agree, function inlining increases the machine code size because typically we'll end up with multiple copies of a function body. Like there might be some weird cases where there's only one call of the function where we don't, but generally we're going to do that. Loop unrolling, we're going to have multiple copies of the loop body. Multiple accumulators is a little more subtle, but we just have extra code to add up all the other accumulators at the end. That's extra machine code to do that. And also to initialize the accumulators at the beginning. So, cases. Cache blocking. So, this is one where it would require more machine code. So, if you think of what we did in cache blocking, we need to add these extra loops. Those extra loops have comparisons and extra instructions that need to be somewhere. So, we're going to have bigger machine code for our cache block code. Okay, so questions about, oh, and moving the calculation outside the loop, I think generally shouldn't be extra machine code. Maybe there would be a little bit extra because we might have to like move a value into a temporary variable or something like that. So it might be slightly extra, might not. Okay, so questions about any of the answers for machine code size? Okay, so let's do the second half. Increase, which one of these would increase the number of instructions executed? Let's start. Thinks cache blocking would increase the number of instructions executed. Okay, so I have, this is, let's use a different kind of, this is kind of in the middle for people, okay, who thinks function inlining would increase the number of instructions executed. We have a, seems like no one's volunteering for that one, okay. Loop unrolling would increase the number of instructions executed. We have maybe one, a couple, okay. Moving a calculation outside a loop would increase the number of instructions executed. Have no volunteers, okay. And multiple accumulators would increase the number of instructions executed. We have pretty good consensus on that. So let's go through, we'll start with the simple ones again. So multiple accumulators, we have those extra instructions to add up the accumulators at the end. The reason why multiple accumulators is still an optimization is because the transformation is letting us do more stuff in parallel. Not that it's going to, you know, not that that stuff is going to be less instructions. For loop unrolling, so loop unrolling, we have this extra code because we have to not only expand, have multiple copies of the loop body, but we have like some extra work to like handle leftover and so on. And I think it's true that if we were typically like running two iterations of our loop we unrolled 10 times, we'd have more instructions executed because we have all that extra code that like sees if we can use the unrolled 10 times stuff, then handles the rest. But in the common case, or assuming your unrolling decision was a good one, that you chose a good number of times to unroll, you know, we would hope not to have more instructions executed. So we'd hope that we'd end up with fewer instructions executed because we'd save on the comparisons and loop indexing operations. If we haven't, we've used loop unrolling in a scenario where it's not good. So function inlining doesn't save instructions, or does save instructions because we're getting rid of the calls and returns and argument setup. That's the whole point. So that was pretty straightforward. Where's my color? Cache blocking. So cache blocking, we had extra code to handle those extra loops. Those are going to be additional instructions. We're going to have to do more comparisons to do our funny loop indexing, where we don't go from 1 to 1,024. If 1,024 is our limit, we're going to go from like 1 to 40, and then back to 1, and then so on. So that's going to be extra instructions that get run. So we're, in fact, going to be executing, for cache blocking, more instructions. Why is it still faster? Because those instructions have less cache misses. And that's why it's worth executing those extra instructions. So questions about any of these answers? So I'm going to spend probably the rest of the time talking about one other class of optimizations, and these have to deal with some instructions we haven't really seen yet. I'm going to start by talking about LoopLab. So LoopLab, on my desktop, which may not be the same as the machine you tested on, when I got to unrolling it and using four accumulators, I got to half a cycle per element. That seems pretty good. So we're basically doing two adds per cycle plus all the indexing stuff in parallel with that. Now, you might compare, so how do the compilers do? So I use some compilers at high optimization levels, you know, try finding the optimization flags that work best, and they manage 0.13 and 0.14 cycles per element. Which seems like I'm saying that this processor can do 8 ads in parallel, and it can, but not in the way that we've talked about before. So far, we've talked about like having 8 separate ad instructions. What we have instead is that there's an instruction that's a single ad instruction that can add, in fact, 16 pairs of shorts that's available on our machines in one instruction. This is called a vector or a SIMD instruction. So vector because we think of a vector as a short array. That's what we're adding. We're adding 2 short arrays to each other. Yes?
Is there also a difference between accumulator assembly versus accumulator C?
Question, is there also, question, I'm showing the timings. Was there a difference between my assembly accumulators and my C multiple accumulators? At normal optimization levels, no. If I like turn up the optimization, I probably get something like the full version where the compiler is doing something rather non-intuitive that we're going to talk about. So there's these special instructions, these vector instructions, or SIMD for single instruction, multiple data instruction, that do lots of pairs of ads instead of just one ad. Or lots of ads of pairs of numbers, sorry, I should say. So they add a lot of pairs of values. And let's talk about what code that uses that looks like. And we'll start with something that's simpler than our sum example. And that's just where we're adding, doing this A plus equals B for every element in 2 arrays A and B of a fixed size. And to use these fancy instructions, our first step is going to basically be to unroll this loop to expose it as the set of 8 operations. And we have a single add instruction. The SIMD or vector add instruction basically does this entire operation of adding 8 pairs of values for where those pair values are 32-bit ints, which is the case here because it's unsigned ints. So there's one instruction that does all those 8 adds. So first I restructure the loop to expose 8 sets of adds. And the assembly I want would look something like this, and I'm going to talk about a bunch of the instructions here because we haven't seen them before. So first thing we haven't seen, actually, is that I'm using this register, YMM0. So YMM0 through YMM15 are 256-bit registers. So that's 32 bytes. So they can store 8 4-byte ints. There are also, on modern x86 processors, a set of XMM registers that are 128-bit. And these have the same kind of relationship with each other that like RAX and EAX has. So the 128-bit registers are just the least significant 128 bits of the 256-bit ones. And the first thing I do is I copy from the array A at some offset, which I store in RAX. I'm going to store in RAX, in fact, a byte, the number of bytes into the array I currently am. And you'll notice that if we look ahead, I advance by 32 bytes each iteration of this loop. So I'm going to copy from there into this 256-bit register. I'm going to load 256 bits from the array, that's 8 ints, all at once into one register. And this instruction starts with a V, that's for vector, basically. For vectors means a small fixed-sized array in hardware terms, so it acts on a full fixed-sized array. And it's a vector, Intel says, of double quad words, even though it doesn't actually matter because we're just loading 256 bits. We'll figure out how that's interpreted when we actually use the register. And the U stands for unaligned. So there are 2 versions of these load and store instructions. There's the unaligned version, which lets you load or store to any address. And there's the aligned version, which crashes your program if the address isn't a multiple of 32. For this class, we'll always use the unaligned version. Historically, there might have been a performance difference, but on most recent processors, that isn't true. There's no performance difference. If you happen to choose a value that's a multiple of 32, it will be faster because it won't cross a cache block boundary. But it will be the same regardless of which version of the instruction you use. It will be faster if you use the unaligned one with that or the aligned one. So we have this load from A into YMM0, and the same from B into YMM1. And Intel, when they made these 256-bit instructions, decided, wait a moment, you know, it's kind of inconvenient that you have to specify a source that's also a destination. So they fixed that here, which maybe is a bit confusing now that we've spent all our time learning two operands. Is that syntax? So we have three operands, source, and destination. And finally, we have a move back into A of the eight values we wrote, we added. And then we have the stuff for the loop. So we add 32 bytes. And rather than comparing to the maximum index, I compare it to the number of bytes, which is why it's 2048, not 512 like it was in the C code, because that was our array index, not our number of bytes into the array. So questions about this C code, this assembly code that we'd like to have generated? Yes?
Is this x86
and those contain like three line instructions, right? The one where you give like three. So question, are these x86 instructions? So these are x86 instructions for the more recent version of x86. So they're not in the, like, if you got a processor from 2010, it probably wouldn't support these. But recent processors support this version of the x86 instruction set that includes these instructions. Where recent means, like, you know, past 8 years. Okay, other questions? Back there? Why are we storing YMM0 into A? So if we look at the original code, the results of all these adds go into the same elements of A. So that's implementing that. Other questions? So I have sort of a visual representation of what's going on. So we have these move instructions that load into YMM0 and YMM1. They're taking eight elements from the array. First, we take 0 through 7, then 8 through 15, and so on. We add them together. We get these sort of sums, pairwise sums. And that's what ends up being stored back into A. Back there? Yeah? Question, how do we know where the set? Where the boundary between integers are. It's a good question. So this add instruction here, which I did forget to go over that. So this stands for basically vector packed add D word. And D word is Intel's term for 32-bit int. So this is a 32, add a vector of 32-bit int instructions. There is also a, say, add W instruction for add 16-bit ints, and an add bytes, and so on. So Intel decided that it was worth, Intel made the original version of this extension, so decided that, oh, it's going to be worth having a whole lot of different types of add instructions and multiply instructions in order to support the different size things you might put in these vectors. Yes?
How does this add operation, like, add these, like, 256 bits of, like, int values in ALU? Do they separate them out?
The question is, how is this implemented in ALU? So there's multiple options, of course. So a processor could, like, do each of the ads separately. But in a typical implementation, we're going to have ALUs which have multiple of what we'll call lanes. So we'll have an ALU that can do multiple of these, hopefully like all eight of them at once, and is somehow reconfigurable as far as what size these lanes are to handle the different types of instructions. So each of these lanes would be one of the elements of the vector. So this is one implementation. We could also have an implementation where we have to like split up the vector and send them separately to the ALU. There have been real processors which do that, but ideally, you know, we'd have something where the processor just has the extra hardware to do that, to do it all at once. Yes?
So is the reason this is more efficient is that it's consolidating down to one instruction, which the ALU can process as one instruction? Like, if the ALU could, like, get thrown eight instructions at once, would that be the same efficiency as this one instruction?
So the question is, yeah, why are we doing this instead of just, you know, having eight ad instructions and relying on an out-of-order machinery to handle it? And you got the reason it's more efficient is because it looks like one instruction. And if we think of what we did to implement out-of-order, we have tons of logic that's not dedicated to actually computing things. We have our instruction queues, our reorder buffers, we have all the instruction fetch logic, all the register renaming logic, all the branch prediction stuff. And when you look at the actual area on the chip, we ended up devoting more space on the chip to things like instruction queues, register renaming, than the actual ALUs. So supplying these wide instructions is kind of a way of getting that space back to being used for actual computation on the chip. And is more easier to make, you know, efficient than if we tried to figure out how to efficiently drive, you know, twice as many adders that were driven, given independent instructions, even though maybe that's also a direction we could go. So this is the basic idea from a processor designer point of view, is that this lets you expose a lot of extra computational capacity without much extra control logic. That's probably why Intel and AMD and pretty much everyone else, well, ARM processors have these sorts of instructions, why everyone wants to implement these sorts of functionality. It has the disadvantage, of course, that, well, we have to change our code, right? We can't just run an existing program and take advantage of, you know, now it seems like, you know, 3/4 of our ALU is just invisible if we aren't using these special instructions. Okay, so questions about our basic SIMD instruction example, or we move on. Okay, so I mentioned when introducing this that for the SUM program, my compilers use this instruction. So you might say, why am I bothering teaching about this beyond as a curiosity if you can just, you know, use your compiler and it's going to use these instructions? And the answer is, well, compilers sometimes do this. They're getting better. But a lot of things are going to mess up the compiler's attempt to transform your code to use these vector instructions. Aliasing is really nasty because in order, like in this example here, in order to use these vector instructions, we needed to know that we could do all these ads at once. Which was like the aliasing example I showed you. Like, we need to know that's safe. If A and B might overlap, that's really tricky. We have things like conditionals. So conditionals seem like a little tricky to make work with that vector add instruction. What if I want to add or subtract depending on a flag? That's seems like a lot of extra work. And there's ways of dealing with it, but it's a lot of extra work. It's not trivial to transform into these instructions. Some operations don't have a vector instruction. So for example, x86 processors generally do not provide vector integer divide. So if you're doing a division and you want to use the vector registers, well, you're going to have to do something really complicated with like multiplies, or you're going to have to do something like copy it into a normal register, do a division, and copy it back. And even in cases where the compiler shouldn't be messed up, the history of how good compilers are at this is pretty bad. Maybe it's gotten better, but when I last looked at this, it was disappointing. So for example, I tested with GCC 8.2 and Clang 7. I have two pieces of code which only differ in the loop order. Both of these have nice ways they can be written using vector instructions. And at high optimization levels, GCC and Clang will vectorize the first one and not the second one. So for the first one, the idea of vectorizing it is that we should like compute these elements of B and all in parallel. For the second one, the idea is we should compute these multiplies all in parallel. We should do a bunch of those at a time. So they're both pretty straightforward to vectorize in some way, but GCC and Clang sort of had the pattern matching to figure out this, in, at least in those version numbers, and not this one. And as a programmer, this is really frustrating because you make some minor change to a program and suddenly, you know, if we think about these vector instructions, they're doing 8 ints at a time, your program is 8 times slower. So, you know, just not very intuitive. And there's other weird things which I've seen come up when you try to see when do they make vector instructions. So for example, in Clang version 5, they fixed this bug later, but the first version of this code made vector instructions and the second didn't. The only difference is in the second I'm using longs to index my array and not ints. Just because they missed a case in pattern matching in their optimizer. So you've got this huge performance difference just by making this what seems like a totally inconsequential change that shouldn't affect anything. So, well, certainly, you know, in the real world, I would certainly try to see what the compiler does first and hope it does a good job. You know, we'd like some better control. And it just seems kind of bad because it seems like, you know, if the compiler doesn't do the right thing, it seems like you're going to have to go to like writing this assembly. And in this case, that was practical, but if we're talking about, you know, the examples I gave here, that's pretty daunting. So there's an in-between space here, and basically hardware manufacturers and compiler writers sort of made this sort of second option besides writing assembly by hand called intrinsic functions. So these are C functions that are going to compile down to a particular instruction or two instructions. So a way you could imagine these are implemented is that they're like just a function with some assembly in them that's marked as always inline, but often it's like might be integrated into the compiler in some way. And this allows us to specify, hey, compiler, please do this vector add here without relying on the compiler pattern matching our code, which is much more unreliable. And that's what we're going to have you use in some upcoming assignments to get to like look at how you would do this when you need to have that sort of more fine control when the optimizer just doesn't do it for you. So I'm going to show an example using this. And first I have to say that we're using these intrinsics that were made by Intel. And Intel made some bad naming decisions, some really bad naming decisions. And we're kind of stuck with them. So one thing you'll notice is that we have these types. So __M256i is a type for 256 bits of integers. Intel uses this type no matter the size of the integers we're dealing with. And that's what it represents. There's also types for floats or doubles. Now, these all really in the represent values in those 256-bit registers. So there's nothing stopping you from taking a 256i and converting it to a 256d. right? As far as the assembly is concerned, we're just using the register for different operations. So the types are just to mark, you know, for your convenience, what type of value it is. You can cast between them. And we have functions that represent basically individual instructions. And we have this naming convention, so they start with underscore MM256. So the MM comes from way back when Intel first started doing these kind of vector instructions. They called them the multimedia extensions. And that name has never gone away. And the 256 represents that they're dealing with 256 bits. Here we have a suffix, and that's a common thing you see, which indicates the types of values these work on. In this case, SI256 means a 256-bit integer thing. And we have a load and a U for unaligned. This means that the processor is not going to complain if the pointer you pass is not a multiple of 32, like if it might go across a cache block boundary. It's not going to complain. It might run slower if it goes across a cache block boundary, but it will work. So then we have an add here. And in this add, we have to specify the type we're adding, because I mentioned that we have like an add 32-bit values, an add 16-bit values instruction, and a whole bunch of them. So here the EPI 32 tells us that we're adding 32-bit integers. PI is for packed integer, that's where the naming comes from, and E is for extended, because there used to be a shorter version of this, and they didn't bother thinking about the implications of that as it got extended even more. So this is EPI 32, add a bunch of 32-bit integers. Questions about instructions? Back there? What does P stand for? The P is for packed. Because the idea is that we've put a bunch of things into one vector, and Intel calls that packing. Yes? The question is, only the recent x86 processors from the past 8-ish years can run this. So the 256-bit registers were introduced around 2011, and it probably took a few years for processors to support them. A prior version of this extension, which looks rather similar with 128-bit registers, was introduced around 1999. I'm showing you the 256-bit version because obviously we prefer to use that because it's going to be a lot faster. And also, it has some extra convenience features that might come up later. Other questions? And I guess I should mention more broadly, other architectures have similar things. So ARM has something called Neon, which provides similar functionality, obviously, with different names for everything. I believe that, so as I said, ARM has something called Neon, so I believe there are vector instructions for ARM too. I'm not sure exactly which ones the M1 implements, but you know, these sorts of things exist for other architectures. We're just using Intel's extensions as an example because that's what the department machines run. Other questions? Okay, so here I've shown you we're doing this with a bunch of 32-bit integers. We could also do this with a bunch of 64-bit integers by just changing, well, we'll advance by 4 at a time instead of 8, because we'll load, you know, if we're loading 64-bit integers, 256 bits of them is 4, not 8 of them. And we say we're doing 64-bit adds in a vector, not 32-bit adds in a vector. And so using these intrinsics just means that we aren't writing the instructions directly, but pretty much each of those special functions we were using is going to translate very directly to an instruction. And each of the variables we had that was that special MM256 type is going to hopefully map to one of the YMM registers. Now, if we use too many of those 256-bit variables, just like with normal variables, the compiler will put stuff on the stack. questions? Example? Okay, so let's exercise. And I have, there's one function in this exercise I need to talk about. This molo is going to, is this is multiply 64-bit values and return the least significant 64 bits of the result. It's so named because there's a high version of this which will give you the most significant 64 bits of 128-bit result. So internally, the ALU computes 128 bits, and the question is, which of those 128 bits do you want? So here we're just taking the bottom 64 bits. So this is what you'd expect a normal multiply to do without if it didn't handle overflow. So the question is, we have this code here. What should this make the bar array become? Who would like some more time? Okay, who thinks it's A? Okay, B, C, D, E, F, G. Okay, so let's see. So let's go through how this works. So first, we're doing 256-bit loads from this array of longs. So longs are 64 bits. So each of these are going to load four longs. So first, we're loading a chunk of 256 bits of stuff starting at index 0 from foo. So that's going to be this 112. Then we're loading a chunk starting at index 4. That's going to be this 334. And we're loading a chunk of bar starting at 0. That's going to be this 2223. And our first operation is this add. So this add is going to add the pairs of numbers between these two parts of foo. So we're going to have 1 plus 3 is 4, and 1 plus 3 is 4, and 2 plus 4 is 6. It was 4 is 6. So that's going to be the value of our first result value. That's just doing each of the pairs between those two. And then we have our multiply operation, which I mentioned is basically what you'd expect a normal multiply to be, even though it's called the low. And we're going to multiply this 4466, which is our current value of result, with bar 0, which is this 2223. So 4 times 2 is 8. 4 times 2 is 8. 6 times 2 is 12. And 6 times 3 is 18. So that's our final value of result, which is going to get stored into bar at 4. So this result is going to end up replacing these four values here. So the answer was G something else. So questions? How to figure out what was going on here? So that's sort of the basics of these vector instructions. So just as a side note, because this might come up on the assignments, so as I mentioned, there was a previous 128-bit version of this extension, and those instructions are still there and still on our processors, and you still might want to use them if you want to do things that are not as big. So there's instructions for them, and you'd expect you just replace 256 with 128, but sadly, Intel didn't have the best foresight when they named these intrinsics, and so they were originally named without any number in the function names, but with the 128 in the type name. So the old intrinsics are just mmadd instead of mm128 or 256add, but the old types are m128, and so on. Okay, so we've looked at sort of how these work, but we had this example, which was very simple, where we were just doing a vector-to-vector add, so adding each pair of elements, which like worked very naturally, but real problems don't seem like they're going to give us such a natural relationship to the way these instructions work. So let's do something more realistic, and we're going to look at how we would vectorize this uncache-blocked matrix multiply. So I have a matrix multiply here, and I want to vectorize this. So my first step is going to be is I'm going to try to expand my inner loop here into, in this case, 8 different operations I can do in parallel. Why 8? Because I'm working with ints, and I know my vectors are 256 bits. That's 8 ints. So I want 8 things that will look the same and do in parallel. And the straightforward way in this case of doing that is to just unroll the innermost loop. So I end up with something like this. And this looks like a great candidate for using these instructions. I can use that multiply a bunch of pairs of values instruction, the 32-bit version of it. And I can use my add a bunch of pairs of values instruction. And it looks like I have 2 nice operations to do. And that should make my matrix multiply be roughly 8 times faster, ignoring cache misses. But we have some problems here. So some things seem straightforward. So I can like load and store 8 consecutive values from C. That doesn't seem like a problem. And I also have, as it turns out, well, because I arranged this problem carefully, 8 consecutive values from B. But A is not so friendly. For A, I need to somehow get a vector of 8 copies of the same value from A. I just want to read one thing from A, not 256 bits of A. And that seems really inconvenient. It seems like the only way, from what we've seen, to do that would be to take A, copy it into like a temporary array to get 8 copies of something and load that. But this sort of operation actually comes up a ton when we want to vectorize stuff. So there's going to be a handy intrinsic for it, which is set called set1. This is the number 1, not the letter L, which is going to load 8 copies of a 32-bit value. As you might imagine, there are other versions of this for, you know, different size values. And you might say, so is there an instruction for this? And basically there is. So this typically will compile into a instruction that moves a 32-bit int to a vector. And then this instruction called broadcast, which, you know, sends that 32-bit int everywhere on the vector. So it's just called broadcasting it. So there's an instruction just to do that because it's such a common operation because of things like this matrix multiply. This pattern comes up a lot. And we're also going to need a 32-bit multiply, which you can guess based on the 64-bit one we saw earlier what that's going to be. So let's look at how I vectorize this inner loop code. So here's our loop. I've just truncated the inner loop body, I should say. I've just truncated things to make things fit on the slide. And if I'm thinking of generating the vectorized code for this, the first thing I would worry about is, well, we're going to have to read C before we add something to it and then store it back. So that's going to look like this. I'm going to read a 256-bit chunk of C. So to specify that, I say give the first element of that chunk. We're going to get 256 bits starting at that, which is going to be the next 7 elements in that element. And I load it into a vector variable that's going to be declared with my M256i type called cij. And I'm going to store it at the end, and there's going to be some code in the middle where I'm going to add something to it. So I also need to do, similarly, load a chunk of B. That's the same kind of pattern. And I need to do this multiply. So we have, this is where our set one comes in. So I load 8 copies of A into a vector and do that pairwise multiply of each of those 8 copies of A with one of the elements from B. And I get my temporary results, which I store in a variable I call multiply results. So questions I got here. So then once we have that multiply results, we just need to add it to C. I already showed how I'm going to load my little chunk of C into a variable. So I'm going to use my add function to do the plus equals operation. So C equals C plus multiply results. And I have my previous store back into C. So I put this all together, and this is what my code looks like. Just using all those intrinsics, it's actually going to vectorize my matrix multiply. Questions about how I got this code? So apparently not many. So let's do this exercise then. So I have some code, and I have a vectorized version of it. I've not put in casts that are needed just to make it less cluttered. And my question is, what goes in the two blanks? Okay, who'd like some more time? One person. Questions before we ask what the answer is, then? Question or? Yes, okay.
So, in the PI part, inside the parentheses, don't you need to, declare how big it is?
So the question is, don't I need a cast in the BI part? Yes. So I've just, as I mentioned here, and I mentioned verbally, I've omitted the cast to reduce clutter. So there are a bunch of casts I need. I just decided that this line was already very cluttered, and the casts are directly determined because we know what type the function takes. Other questions? Okay, so who thinks our answer should be A? B. Okay, C. And D. Okay, so we have consensus on B, which is not the correct answer. So we need to definitely go over this. So let's think about what doing B does. So if we do the B answer, BJ is going to contain B of 0, like initially is going to be B of J, B of J plus 1, and so on, and we're going to multiply A of I times B of J, A of I plus 1 times B of J plus 1. And you should have some red flags here, because that's not what this original loop did. Right? This original loop for B of, multiplied A of I times every B of J, and it seems like we're selecting just one. So we're not doing what the original did. We want to instead you know, take our a of I plus 0, a of I plus 1, a of I plus 2, a of I plus 3, and multiply each of them by b of j plus 1, then b of j plus 2, then b of j plus 3. So the better answer would be C. So let's look at sort of how this came about. So when I vectorized this, I did a transformation into code that looked like this. And you can tell that because, well, if you look at this code here, I'm doing four i's, and I'm loading chunks of four values from a and b based on the index I. So the transformation I did to do that is I kind of made four copies of the operation we're doing for the I loop, which looks like this here, where I have a of I plus 0 plus 1 plus 2 plus 3, which is what corresponds to those elements of I and B we were loading. And when I do that, the B of J's I'm using are every single B of J from 0 to 1023. So each one individually is what I'm doing. And the reason you have this confusion is that the previous example I showed you, I, instead of using the, you know, expanding the outer loop like this, I sort of repeated the operation of the innermost loop, that index. And I chose not to do that when vectorizing this code because that would give me code that looks like this. And this is a lot harder to vectorize. It's possible, but it requires dealing with the fact that, you know, if you look at what this code is saying, is that we're writing the same value to a of I. So we'd have to do some extra step to handle that. That's definitely doable. Basically, we probably get a whole bunch of partial sums and add them together at the end to compute a of I. But I felt that was a lot less straightforward to vectorize. Like the code for that, I need to, when vectorizing it, yes, I could do these vector adds, but I need to do something special at the end to combine them into one a of I value and not four separate a of I values. That would make my logic a bunch more complicated. Some questions? Yeah. So, my answer would be different. So, if we think of a of 0, so in the original code, a of 0, we have plus equals b of 0 times b of 0, and b of 0 times b of 1, and times b of 2, and so on. If we look at the new code, because this is j plus equals 4, when j equals 0, we're going to do the b of 0 times b of 0. Then j is going to be 4, and we're going to do b of 0 times b of 4. We're never going to do b of 0 times b of 1. That.
And I
equals 0 initially. Well,
I know. I'm saying when I equals 1.
I equals 1 in the old code or the new code? I is never 1 in the new code. Okay? So that was your fusion? Yes. Okay. Your question? So the question is, isn't it a problem that we're storing a part in a local variable rather than immediately writing it back to A? So I think as long as we can assume there's no aliasing between A and B, this is fine. Because, you know, this is equivalent to if we wrote it out here and then read it right back immediately. Because nothing else, and it would be equivalent as long as B is not an alias for A. If B and A alias each other, then we'd have lots of problems. Does that answer your question? And I guess, so your question, you know, why is it okay to do that? So the other insight is that in the original code, basically, we could have rewritten this original code. So I did something like int temp equals a of I, and then temp plus equals, and then a of I equals temp. Like, that would not have changed the original code, provided that a and b don't overlap. Because I'm just producing my a of I value all at once, rather than writing intermediate values. But because I'm never reading that back, it doesn't matter if I only write the last value or write all the values. Does that answer your question? Other questions, follow-ups? So one last note about these SIMD intrinsics. So we've seen a bunch of things about, you know, doing these pairwise operations, and we've seen that we have a way of like taking one value and sending it to everywhere in a vector. Another type of operation that processors end up providing when they provide these vector instructions are ways of moving values around in a vector. Because sometimes we're going to find that like we have a vector that's 1, 2, 3, 4, as far as like where things come from, and we want it to move it around so it's 3, 4, 1, 2. So there are instructions and therefore intrinsics for doing this. It has various names like shuffling or swizzling or permuting, depending on who's writing the documentation that day. But often this is an operation we need, and it's kind of an ugly thing the processor kind of needs to provide to make this efficient for us, because otherwise we're gonna have a lot more cases where I try to vectorize something and I find out, oh, doesn't quite work out. Now, if you don't have these, like, you can deal with it, but you're gonna have to do something like rearrange the values on the stack, and that kind of gets rid of the whole point of this, which was to always be working on these big groups of values and not have loops over everything. And as an example, one of the operations that's provided has the name, intrinsic name permute 4x64, and it takes this funny number, which is basically constructed with bit shifting, to say where do you want each index of the inputs to go. And I would say that every single time I have used these shuffling or permuting intrinsics or instructions, I have to look them up. But you know, I can deal with that. Just need to do it every time. And that's, I think, where I'll leave off for today, unless there are questions.